from deep inside your radio.
For the final week from Edinburgh, Scotland, ladies and gentlemen, starting, as one should, with the buried lead. This from an Associated Press story that starts with the words, President Bush has authorized the U.S. Marine Corps to recall 2,500 troops to active duty because there are not enough volunteers returning for duty in Afghanistan and Iraq. Not really big news, but we go down four or five paragraphs, not totally buried, head peeping up, visible in the rubble, and we get to this. A quote from Marine Colonel Guy A. Stratton, head of manpower mobilization. Quote, since this is going to be a long war, we thought it was judicious and prudent at this time to be able to use a relatively small portion of those Marines to help us augment our units. It's going to be a long war, ladies and gentlemen. This just in. This is a special edition of the broadcast, so we're going to get a few things done first, including news from outside the bubble. Copyrighted feature, of course. Who wouldn't copyright it? From The Age in Australia, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad set himself an August 22nd deadline to respond to the Security Council's demands and a package of incentives regarding his nuclear program. In the days leading up to August 22nd, the possibility that the world might have ended within days was apparently contemplated by some U.S. officials. It was taken seriously by the Wall Street Journal, which ran a piece by eminent Islamic scholar Bernard Lewis, known to be close to the White House, which pointed to the significance of August 22 in the Islamic calendar. This was the day, according to the Muslim faith, that the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven on a winged horse before returning to earth. The day, Lewis wrote, when some Muslims, including President Ahmadinejad, believe the world will end. Lewis went on to say it was possible that the president had chosen August 22 for his response to the resolution because, quote, it might be deemed an appropriate day for the apocalyptic ending of Israel and, if necessary, of the world. He continued, it would be wise to bear the possibility of such cataclysmic events in mind, unquote. This just in, the world did not end on August 22nd. It would be wise to remember that, too. Dateline Tokyo, also from The Age, the international black market in nuclear weapons parts involves a Japanese company that's one of the world's biggest precision instruments makers. According to Tokyo police, who've now made a series of arrests, five executives of Mitutoyo Corporation are accused of illegally exporting instruments that were convertible for use in nuclear weapons. Let's put sanctions on the Japanese. The company makes finely calibrated measurement devices, including machines that can be used in the uranium enrichment process. The order for the measuring devices was placed by a Malaysian company, follow me now, SCOMI Precision Engineering, which was set up by rogue Pakistani nuclear scientist Abdul Qadir Khan. There's that name again. There's that country again. Also from The Age in Australia, Dateline Baghdad. The plans are a state secret. So just where the Starbucks and Krispy Kreme stores will be is a mystery, but as the concrete hulks of a huge 21-building complex rise from the ashes of Baghdad, Washington is sending a clear message to Iraqis, we're here to stay. George W. Bush's palace, as the locals have dubbed the new U.S. embassy in Baghdad, is designed as a suburb of Washington. An army of more than 3,500 diplomatic and support staff will have their own sports center, beauty parlor, and swimming pool. The site was a gift from the Iraqi government. Now has a built-in surface-to-air missile station. Its entire construction force is foreign. After almost 4 years, says The Age, the Americans still can't turn on the lights for the Iraqis, but that won't be a problem at the embassy. The same with the toilets. They will always flush on command. All services for the biggest embassy in the world will operate independently from the rattle-trap utilities of the Iraqi capital. The fortress is bigger than the Vatican. It dwarfs the edifices of Saddam's wildest dreams. And, according to the newspaper, irritates the hell out of ordinary Iraqis. A detailed new report issued this week from Britain's top foreign policy think tank, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, says Iran's influence in Iraq has superseded that of the United States, and it's increasingly rivaling the U.S. as the main actor at the crossroads between the Middle East and Asia. We're not acting. We're improvising. The report says the Bush administration has directly helped strengthen Iran to become a major regional power. The war on terror removed the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, Iran's two greatest regional rivals, and strengthened Iran's regional leverage in doing so. Israel's failure to defeat Hezbollah has reinforced Iran's position as the region's focal point against U.S. policy. But here's the cute in this report from the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. Quote, while the U.S. has been playing poker in the region, Iran has been playing chess. Iran is playing a longer, more clever game and has been far more successful at winning hearts and minds, says one of the authors of the report. Hey, poker's good. Poker's big. I don't see any chess shows on cable, babe. In a rare political statement, Iraq's most prominent Shiite, can I say that on the radio, religious leader has urged government ministers and members of parliament in Iraq to refrain from taking trips abroad and to remain in Iraq to focus on improving the lives of ordinary citizens. That's Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani. Would you please make the same request of Mayor Nagin in New Orleans? It's equally necessary. News from Outside the Bubble, a copyrighted feature, and another special feature rarely heard on this broadcast. Los Angeles Dog Trainer Corrections for you. Oh, this is too good to not share. A headline in some editions of Wednesday's food section referred to 1968 as the Summer of Love. 1967 was known as the Summer of Love. This is Le Show, and every couple months this year, we've been having discussions about New Orleans, Louisiana. Today, it's my extreme pleasure and honor to have as my only guest a man who has the uncomfortable distinction of having said it all before it happened, having told us so. And being very, reminding us of that in a graceful but blunt way. And is the author of a new book about Katrina, its causes and its aftermath, called The Storm. He's the deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center, Dr. Ivor van Heerden. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invite.
It's my pleasure. Let's start with the big question. What's the one thing or the couple of things that in your travels around the country you find most people don't understand about what's happened here?
Most people don't understand the scale of the damage, the scale of the problem. And what I try and tell them is, imagine if they went late one evening and drove for 45 minutes through suburbs of their hometown in a straight line. Then they would have an idea of the scale of the area, of the number of homes and businesses destroyed.
45 minutes sounds light to me, because one afternoon I started in the upper ninth and just decided to drive straight through the disaster without ever getting out of the zone, and to drive over to Lakeview, and I found I was driving, but I was not doing a straight line, I was zigzagging, and after 2.5 hours I got numb and gave up.
Well, 45 miles by 45 minutes by 45 minutes. Gives you a fairly large chunk of property. And, it's just to try and get them to understand that this is not just one subdivision. This is not just a small part of a town next to, some lake or something. This is a very, very significant part of greater New Orleans that got destroyed. And I think the most depressing thing now is as you drive through the areas, some of the plants have come back. Some of them are still dead from the salt water. It looks basically the same, except now a lot of the motor cars, the wheels are missing. Still in the same place, still the same mud in the cars. And, the buildings look a little better because the rains washed the mud off. But it's still extremely depressing because you realize every one of those homes had a life, it had a history, had a family. And so where are they? Where are all these people? I mean, you go mile after mile after mile of empty homes. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the most depressing thing, that here we are 9 months later and we still haven't resolved the issue of getting these people back on life, giving them the compensation they deserve, and so that they can start living.
Anything else that you think people don't understand about this that stands out?
I think the other thing that really stands out, and this is a result of, I think, some right-wing press articles, is the idea that everybody who got into trouble in New Orleans was their fault because they stayed and they lived in the city. And what they don't recognize is that 85% of the people actually evacuated. They did what they were supposed to do. They got out. It's not their fault that the levees failed, that their homes got flooded. They did what they were supposed to do. The majority of the people who didn't leave were those that didn't have motor vehicles or were too poor to leave, or with the invalid and disabled who couldn't leave. So there's this perception that it serves them right. Mm-hmm. They should have got out, which is so, so wrong.
Now, I seem to have read in the welter of stuff about this that the vast majority of fatalities were among the aged. Is that correct?
Yes, about 75% of those who died were elderly.
So it's their fault that they're old.
It's their fault that it's their fault that they're in wheelchairs, and it's their fault that they don't own a vehicle and can't drive out.
Yeah. Personally, for me, as I go around the country and as I read the media, even I know you're on friendly terms with them, so I won't get you roped into this. But people like Anderson Cooper, who come down here a lot and congratulate themselves for coming down here a lot, you go to CNN.com. and search for the words Corps of Engineers and levees, and there's so little said going back a year about it, as if what happened to New Orleans is what happened to Mississippi. Do you find that that's a distinction that people still can't make?
Yes. I think there hasn't been a full recognition in the public's eye as to the true nature of what happened, the failure of the federal levees that were built by, designed, constructed by the Corps of Engineers. Perhaps, that aspect of the Katrina story wasn't as newsworthy as the original first 14 days to a month. We have seen that some of the media outlets we thought would be more interested in the levy studies and the outcomes are not really paying much attention to it, which is a pity, because I think we in Louisiana have to get the rest of the country to understand, in order for us to get the funding we need to get our state back on its feet, that the failure of the levees, the whole New Orleans Katrina catastrophe, was a consequence of the federal security system failing. And if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be talking about Katrina right now. There would have been a little flooding, that's it.
You were the leader, or one of the leaders, of one of the three investigations that happened in the wake of Katrina. One of the phrases that Dr. B of the UC Berkeley team used, apropos of what you're just saying, has planted itself in my mind. He said, without the levees failing, we would have had wet ankles.
Exactly. 15% of the water that got into New Orleans came from overtopping the levees. That's all the water that would have been in the city if the levees hadn't have failed.
And it would have been pumped out fairly rapidly, because the pumps would have still worked, right?
Yeah, it would have been very easy to get them out. We didn't have that much wind damage, so there wasn't that much debris which could have clogged the pumps, and it would have been a relatively easy job to get New Orleans back on its feet.
Your involvement in this has been longstanding. You've studied the risk. You made predictions and made them public in ways that even got you in trouble with your superiors at the university, to say this is a danger that's facing us, which is why I said at the beginning that you have told us so. And I'd like to go into what you say about FEMA and its level of preparedness. But FEMA got a pretty good public spanking by the media And the Corps of Engineers seems to have walked away relatively unscathed. Tell me a little bit about, you refer to these the smoking gun of the Vicksburg documents. Can you, in brief, kind of outline what that tells us?
What that document tells us, and others we now have, is that the Corps of Engineers never put a great focus on getting the levees done. It was more a chore that they had to do. And in fact, there were cost-cutting measures all the way through the process. Some of them because of the Corps' own problems with the money, whether it went to too much went to administration or whatever. Some of it because local politicians and levy boards were saying, we don't have enough money. The bottom line was we built these things on the cheap. The Corps of Engineers is very, very good at running their own propaganda machine. And, you know, and they've stayed on their story from day one. You know, when this first started, they were saying this was an act of God, it exceeded the design of the levees and so on, and therefore we're not at fault. And we knew from basically Tuesday evening that that wasn't true, you know, from our own initial research.
What do you think about the report that the Corps itself issued, that 6,000-page document like 3 weeks ago that was a one-day story in the national media that said, well, we kind of screwed up?
You know, I think if you have to recognize that report cost $20 million of our taxpayers' money. They spend more money trying to cover their behinds with that report than they are actually spending on planning what we're going to do in the future. I think the media didn't give it much play because they recognized that the two teams, our team and the guys from University of California, Berkeley, had done very thorough jobs and had put all the science out there. And really all the Corps could do was say, yeah, we screwed up. And the important thing, though, is what happens next. You know, does the state take this and perhaps sue the Corps? We now know the levees failed because the Corps messed up. So what happens next?
You've heard any talk that the state might sue the Corps?
I'm quite sure that the state has given that a lot of thought, and you know, we'll have to see what comes out.
You're exercising for a man with your reputation must be described as unusual discretion and restraint. But you go back through the history of this system and talk about something that seems incredibly complex to the layman, which is the definition of the standard project hurricane, and that's what the Corps was tasked to help protect us from. Talk a little bit about how they apparently defined that downward.
The original standard project hurricane definition was put together in the late 1950s, and it was a result of research at that time. In 1965, Congress ordered the Flood Control Act, and which dictated that we needed to build the levees around New Orleans. The language said that we would build it to, according to the standard project hurricane, which was the most severe meteorological event that could happen. Okay. So the Corps then went to this standard project hurricane definition from 1959. However, the Weather Bureau, as it was then called, the National Weather Service, had realized, well, that definition's too weak. So they updated it. They updated it in 1973. They updated it in 1979 so that we were looking at basically a very, very weak storm on the 1959 definition and a very, very powerful Category 4 storm with the newer definition, 20 years smarter.
Hmm.
But the Corps stayed with the old 1959 definition. What's even more egregious is...
Before you get to what's even more egregious, I have to ask you why they chose to stay with the old definition.
Because it meant you didn't have to make the levees as high, so you could get more bounce for your buck.
Okay.
What made it even more egregious is that the National Weather Service came up with some surge models. And the most famous, or the one they use now, is called Slosh. And the Corps of Engineers helped fund the development of Slosh.
This is a model of storm surge.
This is a model that allows you to predict storm surges for different hurricanes, changing the size of the storm, how fast it's moving, and its angle to the coast, and so on. So it's a powerful tool, the Slosh. The Corps never even used those in their designs, even though they had helped pay for the development of the model and was available from 1979 onwards. Most of the levees that failed were built in the 1990s, 20 years after the Slosh model came out. You know, so the more you look into this thing, the more astounded one becomes, because they ignored the soil data. Instead of using the actual soil strengths at, say, the 17th Street where the levee failed, they used an average, which was a much stronger soil than the actual soil in the ground. So they used something that had a strength of 300 pounds per square foot, whereas the actual strength was 100 pounds per square foot. They in some cases, had come up, the original design was a very, very robust, what we call T-wall design, but they ignored that. They went to I-walls. They shortened the sheet piles.
Sheet piles are the steel pilings that they drove into the top of the levees to anchor them in the soil beneath, yes?
Yes, the sheet piling is interlocking steel plates that they drive into the ground. They have two functions. One is to actually support the concrete wall that's built onto the top of them, so they therefore stability and foundation. The other is to they're a water barrier to stop water getting from the canals or the lakes underneath the levee system out onto the where the homes were. If you have that water piping, as we call it, percolating underneath the systems, you can create the slippery surfaces, and that would lead to the failure of the system, which is exactly what happened in many cases.
And what was Katrina. What was the problem with the sheet pile system that they...
Well, if you look, let's say, for example, the 17th Street Canal, the sheet piling went to 17 feet below sea level. The canal is about 2 feet deeper. It was very, very soft soil. By way of comparison, the repairs they've done there now, they've pushed the sheet piling in to over 70 feet. So from 17 to 70. You know, it gives you an idea of just how bad they misunderstood the soil strengths, or, as we now know, how badly they miscalculated.
We are depending now in this area for the rebuilding of this system and for our protection in the current season and next season of hurricanes on the very same Corps of Engineers. You do not live in the New Orleans area. If you did, would you feel reassured by that prospect or anxious about it?
You know, I guess the proverb that would hold here is once bitten, twice shy. And I think the Corps has learned a huge lesson. And no matter how much they've stayed on spin and, you know, that there hasn't been a super amount of coverage, they themselves, as professionals, you know, have got to be really shaken, because their system failed, the whole system, the design, the construction. And on top of that, along came some jerks from universities, and they totally disproved the Corps' theory on what went wrong. So I think their professional attitudes, the fact that they've really been hammered, will ensure that they don't make this mistake a second time.
You say that, and yet I remember in January they're repairing the levee on the industrial on the east side of the industrial canal, and I think it was Dr. B was looking over their shoulder and saying, "You're using soft soils again."
Dr. B, prior to that, one of our team members, and then after that, myself. Yeah. On a different section of the levee. Yes, they were using sand. And part of, you know, part of our role funded by the state was to, wherever possible, to check up on what they were doing, and as well as trying to determine why the levees failed. So, you know, it was after that that we suddenly heard the Corps was bringing these plays from Mississippi. So again, it was a case, in my opinion, they were trying to cut corners, and we caught them, you know, and not just we in Louisiana, the Berkeley team as well.
Yeah. So my question as a resident part-time of this community is, are you and the Berkeley team still looking over their shoulder, and how long will you be able to continue to do that?
We're going to look over their shoulders until the end of June, which is when our contract runs out. The Berkeley guys, their contract has run out. We have both made recommendations that there needs to be an oversight team made up of Team Louisiana, the Berkeley team, and some folk from the American Society of Civil Engineers. And we need to be reviewing everything that the Corps does, both in terms of repair and designs for the future. And in addition, there should be some funding to go out and find the weak spots in the levees that we haven't found yet, because there are some other weak spots in the system. So far, that funding hasn't materialized.
Who would be providing that funding, ideally?
Well, what we suggested, it should be FEMA. Because
this sounds like a truly Kafkaesque scheme. To be saved from the depredations of the Corps of Engineers, you have to turn to the kindly mercies of FEMA.
And the only reason being is that would fall into their kind of response and recovery tasks.
We're speaking to Dr. Ivor van Heerden, a deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center. We've now talked about the Corps of Engineers as being the cause of what happened to New Orleans, but the major attention was focused on the response in the wake of the flooding. And there are those who say, well, this is not a primary federal responsibility, it's a state and local responsibility.
FEMA was set up because the states didn't have the ability to handle these big catastrophes. That's part of the reason FEMA was set up, as a result of various governors going to the White House and saying, we need a federal organization. During the Clinton years, FEMA was really built up to be a very, very good operation that worked extremely well. Unfortunately, since then, we've dismantled FEMA. We've moved it into Homeland Security. We took people out. We put political appointees to run it. If you're going to be involved in disaster response and you're going to manage it, you have to be somebody who's come up the ranks. You know, it's a trial by fire sort of thing. You've got to be someone who's been through more than one disaster, has felt it, smelt it, and only then do you have some of the expertise needed to manage this. One of the big failings with FEMA was that we didn't have those sorts of folk running the operation.
At what point did this become FEMA's responsibility for primary response? And had that been rehearsed during the Hurricane Pam scenario of the year before?
As soon as President Bush declared a state of national emergency, FEMA's in charge. Federal government's in charge.
And that's the Saturday before landfall.
That's right. And that's very clear in the Stafford Act. So really, that's when FEMA should have been moving. In fact, the Stafford Act actually has language that says FEMA should get involved in evacuations. So, you know, 13 months before Katrina, we had an exercise in Baton Rouge funded by FEMA called the Hurricane Pam exercise. It was a far more catastrophic storm, fictional storm, but still, than Katrina. It flooded a much greater area. More people died. More people had to be evacuated. And 500,000 people were going to be homeless, and so on and so on. And we spent 10 days going over this scenario. And we had breakout teams. We looked at how you do the rescue, temporary housing, so on and so on. So FEMA, and they were there in force, as was the U.S. military, as was the Corps of Engineers, and a representative of the White House, heard all the different things that could go wrong, did an exercise, and had a private consulting company produce some initial documentation. So FEMA knew, you know, well beforehand what exactly could go wrong. Or somewhere between doing the exercise and the actual response, things broke down completely.
There's an episode you talk about in the Hurricane Pam period involving the issue of tent cities.
You know, we realized years ago from our own research that if you had a storm like Katrina or something worse, there would be hundreds of thousands of people who would be homeless. And how do you deal with that? So I and one of my coworkers went overseas to do a course. And the response is you build tent cities. And we spent 2 weeks in England with experts in this from all over the world and went through how you set up the tent cities, what do you need, et cetera, and how quickly you can do it. So when I came back, I was brimming with this energy. Yeah, we're going to have this exercise. We must think about tent cities. And FEMA's response was, Americans don't live in tent cities, kind of laughing at me. I was like, you know, lady, you're going to be crying. You're going to be crying because how are you going to deal with them? And exactly, look what happened. We were bringing buses and airplanes and flying everybody everywhere so that New Orleans ended up being spread over all 50 states.
As you describe it in your book, the tent cities, had they been planned for, would have had medical, catering. It would have been a city in terms of an actual set of needs catered to, as opposed to a Superdome, let's say. I guess Americans do live in football stadiums.
Yeah, we lived in football stadiums all over the place. People did live in tents for a long while on their own. And now we're living in trailers all over the place. The key thing is, if you have a tent city, as you bring people in, you can do medical assessments. You can get names. You can find out what sicknesses they have or what their medical requirements are. You can have a clinic, and you can have a big mess tent. You can have meetings in the mess tent to help people fill out paperwork. What do you deal with your mortgage, et cetera, et cetera. One of our biggest fears was, as they pulled all these people out of New Orleans, that we would see some folk with some very contagious disease spread all over the country, and the next thing we got problems. Mm. And that could have happened. There were a number of, there were about 11 persons who had the very drug-resistant TB. You know, and it took about 3 weeks to track them all down.
Wow.
You know, so just imagine if we'd had something else. We were, in some ways, we were very lucky that we didn't see some disease spread over the country.
In discussing matters of luck, you say in the book that compared to all of the exercises that you'd run, all of the predictions you'd done, you're even now thinking that the supposed death toll from Katrina is a low figure.
Since I wrote the book, they've updated the numbers, and what they recognized were a lot of the missing, about 500 of the missing, their homes aren't there. Their homes were completely destroyed by the rapid flowing waters. So there's a very good probability that they didn't make it. Mm. And you can imagine if the house is not there and they were in their 80s, then they would have been very early casualties. You know, one doesn't hope it gets much higher, but, you know, it's going to end up around 1,500 people.
I want to just backtrack to the detective work that you and your team have been doing, and you're gracious in sharing the credit for all the work and naming the people who've been working with you and paying tribute to them in the book. You know a lot about water depths and elevations, and you have this kind of material in these very sophisticated databases. Do you have any? I mean, I just was in the lower ninth again yesterday, and the thing that seems to separate that place and maybe St. Bernard, I haven't been down to St. Bernard, from the damage in Lakeview and Mid-City, seems to the layman's eye to be the power of the water. Do you have any idea how fast the water was coming at people in the Lower Ninth?
In the Lower Ninth, at the two breaches on the Industrial Canal, the wall of water would have been 18 feet high. So you can imagine a wall of water 18 feet high, 500 feet wide, all of a sudden, like a dam, just going at you. It was strong enough that the first five streets, the houses were totally destroyed. Mm-hmm. You can go back 10 to 12 streets and you find houses that are moved off their foundations. So the initial flood through there would have been absolutely horrendous. That whole St. Bernard Bowl, of which the Lower Ninth is part, experienced very high waters early in the process. So they got water up to 12 feet above sea level and recognize they're on average about sea level or just below. So that 12 feet above sea level, that's higher than most of the homes, the eaves. Mm. Many, many homes were totally submerged.
Mm.
So the St. Bernard Bowl flooded by about 10 o'clock on the Monday, the day the storm hit. They'd had the peak of their flood.
Mm.
The other two bowls were different. They broke actually as the levees failed, as the surge was setting down, and the levees broke, and it took 4 days to fill those bowls as Lake Pontchartrain drained into the city.
Now, you have this timeline explicated in the book, and does your timeline collate with that animation that's been in the Times-Picayune that shows the...
Yes, we had long discussions with them, and they used a lot of our data for that.
So people can see that. If you go to NOLA.com, there's an animation that shows the pace and the order in which breaches occurred and flooding occurred.
Yeah, we're actually working with some folk from the Netherlands to come up with perhaps a little bit more accurate depiction. Mm.
But it's still shocking to me that Monday morning, shortly before the hurricane makes landfall, or shortly after the hurricane makes landfall, the flooding begins. And awareness of the flooding isn't widespread until Tuesday afternoon?
That's right. The first flooding started at around 4:30 in the morning, and by 11 o'clock it was over. In terms of the breaches.
Mm-hmm.
The actual, as I said, it took 4 days to fill up some of the bowls. What's absolutely incredible to us is that the word never got out, even though key people knew. The city knew, FEMA knew, the Corps of Engineers knew, but the word never got out until we started seeing the imagery on some of the TV networks around just after lunch on Tuesday. And some of the local radio stations in New Orleans started to say, hey, we're in trouble. You know, the waters, the levees have failed. So what's important there is, A, it indicates communications were bad, or somebody was holding on to the information and didn't want it to get out.
Oh, like you could keep that a secret.
Well, nobody acknowledged all the breaches until we got on an airplane and flew around and told the media, hey, we've counted 28 major breaches and... You know, there's probably another 30 or 40 little ones. But the point I wanted to make is what many people don't realize is residents, after the storm, if they didn't live close to a breach, went outside, said, oh, we've dodged a bullet.
Lovely sunny afternoon.
Yeah, went to bed early because there's no radio, no TV, no electricity, etc. for most of them. Went to bed early, woke up in the middle of the night, the water was lapping on the sides of their beds. They tasted it. It was salty. All they could do, it was dark, was go up their attics. Now, if you've ever tried to punch a hole through your attic, through your roof, you'll realize how tough a job it is.
Well, you're having to carve upwards.
Carve upwards, but you've got plywood that's covered by tar paper, that's covered by asphalt tiles. It's a very, very robust structure, you know, unless you have the right tools or you're pretty strong, it's very, very difficult to break through those attics. And, you know, some of the TV imagery in the beginning, you saw firemen and Coast Guard folks with axes actually pounding into the roofs, and they were getting people out. What was tough for us was we were mapping all the 911 calls, and a lot of these were coming from people in their attics, and they couldn't get out. And the best day we had was the state police rescued 79 people out of their attics who would never have got out, and that was like after a week. You know, how they kept their batteries alive for a week, I don't know. But so a lot of folk, unfortunately, drowned in the attics or died in the attics because they weren't found.
You've studied, as part of your work, not just the disasters in this area, but disasters around the world. In May, I was in San Francisco, and the Chronicle did a series of looking back at the San Francisco earthquake on its centenary. And I was struck by their report of the response after the San Francisco earthquake. Two things stuck with me. One, Congress assembled in session at 4 o'clock the next morning to appropriate aid. And two, that the Army requisitioned all available tents and sent them to San Francisco for a tent city.
Yes.
We've come a long way in 100 years.
You know, if you look at the Hurricane Andrew storm 13, 14 years ago, and the response to that, it was as bad as Katrina.
The response was?
Yeah.
And this was in Florida?
This was in Florida, Homestead, Florida, you know, near Miami. Many say part of the first Bush's downfall was reflected in the fact that there was this failed response to Hurricane Andrew. Then we built up a wonderful response organization. But in the last 6 years, we totally dismantled it. So that here today in 2006, we're probably no better off than we were in 1906 with the thing. And it's an absolute shame when you think about how much money has been put into Homeland Security and these other agencies that FEMA is part of.
There are those who use this as an object lesson in the futility of depending on the federal government for anything. Anybody who's lived here knows what heroes the Coast Guard was during this disaster. CDC, you talk about in your book, what a professional, heads-up, focused agency that is. How can it be that one of these agencies is such a heads-up agency and another is such a head-up-its-ass agency?
I think the difference is CDC is run by professionals, medical professionals. You know, they respond to disasters all over the world. They really understand their mission. And their whole structure is aimed at their mission. In the case of FEMA, we didn't have disaster professionals running it. And that's reflected in their lack of appreciation of how bad the situation was and the lack of response. So, you know, what's key is who's running the organization. You know, CDC has had some tough times in the Bush years with budget cuts, but they've still, from what we've seen, kept their eye on the ball. Unfortunately, that didn't happen with FEMA.
Anticipating the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina and the wave of coverage that is already upon us and is to come, the show is reprising our interview with Dr. Ivar van Heerden of the LSU Hurricane Center. And there's more from Dr. van Heerden moments from now. But first, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The Macaca controversy refuses to die. Virginia Senator George Allen apologized directly to S.R. Siddarth on Wednesday, telling the 20-year-old Democratic campaign staffer that he, Allen, was sorry for offending him, Siddarth, with remarks that have generated nationwide criticism for being racially insensitive. Allen called Siddarth by phone. First contact between the two since Alan was caught by Siddharth's video camera calling him, Siddharth, a macaca. Siddharth said Alan told him the apology was, quote, from his heart. His main point was he was sorry he offended me, says Siddharth, a University of Virginia student. He realized how much he offended me from the comments I made in the media. Alan also told Sean Hannity that he was sorry on Hannity's nationwide radio talk show host. I take full responsibility. I'm not offering any excuses because I said it and no one else said it, referring to the word macaca, which is believed to be a racial epithet referring to a genus of monkey. Alan continued on Hannity's show, it's a mistake. I apologize, and from my heart, I'm very, very sorry I said it. He also apologized at a retirement community, saying, quote, from the deepest part of my heart, I'm sorry, and I will do better. When he arrived at the Shenandoah Valley to take a factory tour, the local NBC affiliate demanded another apology. I made a mistake, Alan obliged. It was a mistake, and I'm sorry for it, very sorry for it, and I'm going to try to do better. Then the ABC affiliate wanted to talk to him. Oh, goodness, the senator said. I regret it. It was a mistake. I'm solely responsible for it, and I'm very, very sorry. More to come. Virgin Atlantic Airways has apologized to passengers trapped on a jet for 7 hours and offered a free flight in compensation. Police were called to the plane as officials feared a riot after the packed 747 sat on the runway at Gatwick Airport because of a string of technical problems. Flight 63 finally left for its destination, Cuba, 27 hours late. Things still did not go smoothly. Takeoff was delayed because the plane was dirty and had not been refueled. Virgin says, we apologize for the inconvenience and frustration caused. We've launched an investigation. Passengers have each been offered tickets for a free return flight in the future or a full refund if they choose not to take the plane. Cuba. They fly to Cuba from Britain, ladies and gentlemen. Teen singer Cassie, don't say who, has apologized to fans for her lackluster live performances. The 19-year-old posted a message on her MySpace page, owned by Rupert Murdoch, insisting she's desperately trying to improve her stage shows. She writes, quote, I am aware that my live performances have been pretty bad. I'm still getting over stage fright. I know the feeling, babe. Four British media organizations, three of them tabloid newspapers, have apologized after publishing and broadcasting pictures of Kosar Zaman, 24-year-old British citizen, an employee of the City of London, mistakenly identifying her as Kosar Ali, who's been arrested in connection with a suspected airliner terrorism plot. One of Ms. Zaman's lawyers said following the apologies, she will be pursuing damage claims from the newspapers and independent television news. So apparently apologies aren't always enough, ladies and gentlemen. Don't tell George Allen. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Continuing our conversation with Dr. Ivar van Heerden, Deputy Director of the LSU Hurricane Center, let's talk about you a little bit. You've been very outspoken. There was a piece in the New York Times a few weeks ago that said you got leaned on a little bit. You are not tenured.
No. I could be laid off with 24 hours notice.
Wow. Yeah. And yet you continue to sound the alarm.
You know, to me, it's a case of principles. And the principle here is that we didn't do what we needed to do. I'm in the position, because of the research that was funded through my center, of having a very good understanding of what went wrong and what could go wrong in the future. So it would be very wrong for me just to keep quiet. The bottom line is the truth has to be out. And what we were seeing during Katrina was that the truth wasn't getting out. And if you think about science is actually a quest for the truth. If you want to know how something works or why does this plant grow? You're really just trying to find out the truth of how it grows. So for us, it was an easy step to say, to go from here's the science, here's what we've seen wrong, and here what we see needs to be done. I say an easy step, but there were there were a large number of roadblocks put in the way.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the Netherlands, and I think a lot of people in New Orleans right about now are wondering. We've seen state delegations go over to the Netherlands. We've seen delegations from the Netherlands come over here. They are reported, by what we can see, to have a state-of-the-art flood control and water management system, part of which was inspired by their disastrous floods and their visit over here.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just hire them to do this?
That's what I would do. You know, the problem is the Corps of Engineers is a huge, huge organization. And it's totally dependent on these earmarks and these projects it gets from Congress to survive. And they and their supporters are not about to say, oh, we're going to bring outsiders in and do it. You know, so behind all of this maneuvering and political stuff is the fact the Corps of Engineers wants to hang on to the role it has in society. It wants to still be the nation's engineers. It still wants to build all these projects and have all this money. And, of course, there's a large number of companies that benefit from these projects, and so they don't want to see the Corps disappear, so they keep the lobbyists funded, and the lobbyists try and get the money for the Corps, and so we have this kind of circle, and none of those people in that circle want to see it broken. Mm. And that's the problem.
And in the Netherlands, do you have the lead agency being basically a contracting agency and multiple tiers of subcontractors as we have with the Corps here?
Yes, yeah, so the kind of similar, but the big difference is there are reviews, design reviews. So if somebody comes up with a design, it gets reviewed by multiple groups, peer independent reviews, so that they can assess it. They do risk and probability analyses, so they understand what the risk is. Is that levee going to be overtopped? You know? But most importantly, all major projects are put out as design competitions. Just as we would if we were going to build a new skyscraper here in New Orleans, we'd put it out for design competition to architects, and then we take the best design. That's what they do in the Netherlands. And then they have these independent teams that go through the designs, and they then choose the relevant design. And in that way, you get the brain power of everybody.
Distributed brain power.
Yes, not just those select few within your organization.
I understand there's one other difference, that we're building for a 100-year flood, and they're building for
10,000 years. In fact, we now know that most of New Orleans levees aren't even 100-year flood levees. They're less.
Hmm.
And they take a 10,000-year view. When you go to the Netherlands, you realize that we could restore everything in Louisiana. We could have secure levee systems. We could ensure that we never get another Katrina. You know, the Dutch have done it. They're a small country, 16 million people. You know, we're a huge country with enormous resources. They said, in their equivalent to Katrina in 1953, they lost 1,800 Dutchmen, and that's never going to happen again. In Katrina, we lost 1,500 Americans. Are we going to ensure that that never happens again? If we are, then we need to do what the Dutch did, and that's build the right levee systems and restore the wetlands.
Yeah, I didn't want to let this conversation end without talking about the wetlands, which you do with a great mixture of urgency and poetry in your book. What has to be done with regard to the wetlands of Louisiana?
Well, I think number one, we have to recognize that they are the buffer to the surges. And then we need to restore them. And there are two important things that we could be doing right now. Our outer line of defense are the barrier islands. We could go offshore in federal waters, and there's high-quality sands. We could mine those sands and rebuild the barrier islands in just a few years. You know, that's something we can start with tomorrow. A lot of the planning has already been done by different state agencies.
Just to connect a dot here, barrier islands and wetlands actually mitigate the ferocity of a hurricane before it makes landfall. Is that correct?
That's correct. It sucks both wind energy out of the system and knocks down the surge. So if we, the next important thing is the Mississippi River built coastal Louisiana over the last 8,000 years. All we got to do is let the river loose so that it can maintain the wetlands and build new wetlands. Right now, the Mississippi River is a canal that flows through Louisiana to the Gulf of Mexico, and all that goodness, all that sediment, all that soil, all those nutrients go straight out into the sea, into deep water. So if we could divert those, if we could have diversions, siphons, all kinds of different structures, we could get those nutrients and sediments, that life-giving material, back into the wetlands and really restore the wetlands. Then we need to really think about one levee system for the whole coast. Instead of all these multiple little systems of different designs, we need to kind of, like the Dutch did, draw a line in the sand and say, we're going to build this levee system. If you think of it this way, the homes and the infrastructure would be protected by the levee, the super levee. If you restore the wetlands then protect your levees. And you restore the barrier islands, your barrier islands then protect your wetlands.
You're talking about redundancy.
Exactly. Hmm. But using nature rather than concrete.
Dr. Van Heerden, again, I'm very appreciative of all your work. And we should all be, asking our congressman to fund you guys to keep looking over the shoulder of the Corps, yeah?
Yeah. No, we need to. We need to do that. But thank you for this invitation, this opportunity to share.
Thanks again. Ladies and gentlemen, apropos, Dateline New Orleans, a New Orleans couple waited nearly a year for a FEMA trailer only to have it explode minutes after they got inside. Fire officials say flammable vapors somehow ignited, causing an explosion and a rolling wave of fire throughout the trailer. The cause is under investigation. My bet, formaldehyde fumes. They've already been investigating that. And the new planet definition that relegates Pluto to dwarf planet status is drawing intense criticism from astronomers. I'm just amazed activists haven't demanded that it be redefined as a little people object. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show from Edinburgh, Scotland. The program returns next week at the same time from New Orleans over these same stations. It would be just like the media getting it right on New Orleans for a change if you'd agree to be with me then. Would you? All right. Thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. And thanks to Graham Warman and Chris at Radio 4th here in Edinburgh, Scotland, for helping with today's broadcast. And as always, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to Pam Halstead. By the way, Dr. Van Heerden's book about Katrina, the causes and the consequences, is The Storm. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from Edinburgh.